listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Saturday, January 5th, 2019. Welcome to the first Spingola Speaks program of the new year. This is Deanna Spingola, broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs. I appreciate you joining me today at republicbroadcasting.org. I invite you to visit and subscribe to spingolaspeaks.net and screeningsandyhook.net. And during the program, email questions or comments to comment@spingola.email. If you inadvertently add an S at the end of comment, it will still get to the right place. Unless you are a troublemaking troll, please visit our chat room at spingola.chatango.com. View our past, current, and future guest lineup at spingola.com. There you will find a schedule all the way back to October 23rd, 2010. That was the day that I began broadcasting on RBN. And we have all the links for all the guests there. And so it's really quite a resource if you want to look at notes or references that the guests used. So it's a great resource. My guest, the first 2 hours, is Mark Shaw, and he is such a wonderful writer. Oh, I just love his work. He's got the website, The Reporter, WhoKnewTooMuch.com, MarkShawBooks.com, the Dorothy Kilgallen Story.org, and I have several links on the schedule page, and that is at Spingola.com. Press the button on the left that says radio schedule and then choose the appropriate month, because I have the last, What's My Line program and, some other links of interest. Mark Shaw is a former criminal defense attorney. He is an investigative reporter and the author of 20 plus books. He is the former legal analyst for USA Today, CNN, and USA Today. He is a California attorney and investigative reporter, and he's done such wonderful work on the topic we're going to talk about today. And it's just, welcome, Mark. You've pulled me in again to talk about Dorothy Kilgallen. I remember her on What's My Line, and I probably didn't appreciate her integrity and her intelligence at the time. But what an extraordinary job you've done.
I didn't know much about Dorothy either, Deanna. I mean, it's amazing. Most people didn't, you know, they just watched that television show on Sunday nights at 10:30 live from New York, What's My Line, and Dorothy, of course, was usually the panelist on the left, along with Bennett Cerf and Arlene Francis, and then they had a celebrity panelist as well. John Daly was the host, and that show was on for, I don't know, 15-some years, very popular, and so I'm just like you. That's all I knew about Dorothy. I always was amazed at her intellect and how she was able to, for people that don't remember, they brought people on with unusual occupations, if you remember, and she was always the one, it seemed like, that was like the prosecutor who was trying to really figure out what their occupation was, whether they owned a wax museum or in one instance where a woman sold dynamite or whatever it was. She was really, I think, in many people's minds, the star of that show.
Yes, I agree. And I didn't appreciate it at the time. It was just, and I didn't know what else she did.
That's right.
But you've certainly just, I'm so fascinated by her story and her life and her integrity and her desire for the truth and the part she played in various criminal investigations. Mm-hmm. She was a college dropout, for goodness sakes, but she was this extraordinary writer and investigator and was just dogging for the truth. I mean, she just was an amazing woman.
I want to say this because I was looking at your website and what you've been doing for all these years, and Dorothy would have applauded you. She would have felt like that you were a woman of integrity and of the truth just like her. And that was, you know, her staple. You know, so many people have read both The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, which came out last year, and very blessed to have it be a bestseller, and now the new book, Denial of Justice, about Dorothy, have said we wish we had reporters like Dorothy today, because, you know, I didn't know anything about that aspect of her life, like you said, but we found out through research, and I believe Dorothy kind of heading me in the right direction at times to find evidence about her life and times and her death, that she was a remarkable woman. And we have to remember too that, back in the 1950s, late 50s and early 60s there before she died in 65, you know, women were supposed to not be in the back seat of a car. They were supposed to be in the car behind. So when you say she was a college dropout, yes, she was, but she also overcame all of those gender biases that there was about women. She became a crack investigative reporter. She had a radio show listened to a million people a day in New York City. She covered many of the high-profile trials of the 20th century. Her newspaper column was syndicated to 200 newspapers across the country. We go on and on. But it's an amazing story, and it's very inspiring for a lot of young women who have gotten in touch with me that read the books, who would like to use Dorothy as inspiration for their own career.
And I agree with you. I think that she's inspired you to find the things that she would have you find.
Oh, no question about it.
I really do believe that.
Yeah. Some people will think I'm a little loony, but Dorothy, for whatever reason, chose me to tell her story, and I'm honored that she did. I've become her voice. I've been fighting for justice for a number of years now because she didn't get justice when she died in 1965 under mysterious circumstances. But I could give you, and I'd be happy to name two or three of them if you want me to, that instances where, you know, she basically spoke to me and told me to look in this direction or that direction, or evidence was going to be here or there. And when I followed up on those suggestions from the hereafter, I suppose you would say, they always led to new evidence that was important, primary source evidence, especially, Deanna, because I saw on your website that you believe, as I do, we want to look at primary source evidence, not a lot of speculation. And so Dorothy led me, as people can tell in both the books, that, you know, I wouldn't have found otherwise. So bless her. She's been right there with me as I've gone through writing both of these books.
I believe that. I'm getting emotional just hearing you say that, because I really do believe that she channeled you, or whatever you call it. I believe that she inspired you, and the details that you've included and the people that you've interviewed, I don't know that you would have been able to interview those people or to even know about that you should interview them without some kind of inspiration, because the book is just fabulous. I can hardly put it down, really.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I would have never known about Dorothy had I not written a book about Melvin Belli, who was the lawyer for Jack Ruby. And when I did, I started hearing about Dorothy and the fact that she was connected to the JFK assassination and had been at the Ruby trial and all of that. And so, you know, I put a little bit of that in that book, and then I wrote a book called The Poison Patriarch about Joe Kennedy and you know, what I felt was the most logical reasons why JFK was killed, and I was going to quit right there. But Dorothy wouldn't let me do that, and so she started to kind of head me in the direction of finding information for the reporter who knew too much first, and then I was never going to write the second book, Denial of Justice, which just came out, but I heard from readers all over the world who had listened to programs like yours and heard about Dorothy's life. They knew about her life and times. They knew about her death. They knew about this or that. And so I started compiling this file, and I knew I had enough for a second book, especially when I was led to some documents that I believe are the most important documents about the JFK assassination ever exposed. And we can talk about those in a little bit, but she led me right to them. So I feel like she's right here with us now, one way or another. And hopefully she's appreciative of what I've been able to do, because as you know, Deanna, she was basically forgotten.
She was.
From 1965 until I was able to come up with this material. There was a book written about her in the 70s, but it was incomplete. But until 2016 and 17, when The Reporter Who Knew Too Much came out, people had forgotten her. Except for, of course, the fact that they would watch What's My Line reruns, but otherwise they knew nothing about the rest of her career. So I'm pleased that I've kind of brought her back to life in some ways, and people have just been amazed and fallen in love with Dorothy. I heard from somebody the other day who's taken flowers to her grave site in New York City. Can you imagine that? It's just
that
amazing the love they have for Dorothy. Yeah.
That is just terrific. And I read your first book, and we had you on the program, and we talked about it. And as soon as I saw that you had another book out, I thought, oh my gosh, we've got to get him back on, because we have to, because you have so many more details, and some of the people that you've, like Doyle, the policeman, and all of a sudden he becomes a restaurant owner. Just these details. They're just amazing.
We should explain probably. And the new book, Denial of Justice, is written for people that read the first book and those that didn't. But, we should tell people, Dorothy Kilgallen, was this investigative reporter. And you mentioned that she had, was at the top of her career. At the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, you can see all these photographs of her and her quotes about her and videotaped interviews with Dorothy and everything else there. And it chronicles her career, basically. It's a tribute to her because, yes, she had the What's My Line, she had the newspaper articles, but when she took off after the JFK assassination, when he died, and we should tell your listeners, as I think I did the first time I was on here, was personal for Dorothy because
yes,
she knew Jack Kennedy from social, events before he died. He had been to her home in New York City, played charades with her, so she knew him. But she took her little son, Carrie,
yes,
to the White House, and there's a photograph of Dorothy and Carrie on that website I just mentioned. And when she did, JFK made a big fuss over the little boy.
Yes.
And, gave him a PT-109 pin and looked at his letters he brought from the third grade class and all of that. And so when he died, it was personal. And so Dorothy, who had covered the Lindbergh baby kidnapping case, she had covered the Dr. Sam Shepard case, which became the fugitive movie. She really loved to be able to look into and investigate criminal matters. And so she went to the Ruby trial. She was the only one to interview Jack Ruby twice. She was writing a book for Random House about everything she had figured out from her investigation, all of that evidence. And after she made a trip to New Orleans to tie in Oswald, Ruby, and this Carlos Marcello, the New Orleans Don, she was going to make another trip. But before she could, she was found, if you recall, in a bedroom.
Yes.
She never slept in, wearing clothes she never wore to bed, or makeup, eyelashes, and hairpiece on.
Yes.
It was obviously a staged death scene, but the New York medical examiner decided that she had died accidentally of an overdose of barbiturates and alcohol, and that was it. It was done. It was dead. There was no further investigation until I could be able to pick that up from information and evidence that I found for the reporter who knew too much.
Right. And the medical, the ME's office, she lived in Manhattan, and they brought somebody in from where, Brooklyn?
Yes, you're right. And you talked about Detective Doyle, for instance. There were all
yes.
kinds of confusing things there. He was the detective who was on the scene at the at Dorothy's Manhattan townhouse. We've since learned through a witness that Dorothy brought to me, a retired sheriff's deputy from outside of New York City who knew Doyle and
right.
talked about Doyle of actually being there at the scene, but also that he had a police report which is, you know, vanished. We've never been able to find it. So Doyle was involved, but the really crazy thing there, as you said, was shortly after the Dorothy died, he resigned from the police department and ended up a few months later opening a restaurant that would have cost a lot of money to do. Didn't make any sense with regard to that. And so there's a lot of crazy things that have happened, but again, the real problem here is that there was no investigation in 1965 of Dorothy's death. And you know, we would all hope that people would come forward if something like this happened to us, because there was no evidence, as you know, that Dorothy had any drug problems or alcoholic problems, and yet not her family, not her friends, not her What's My Line colleagues, the newspaper people, nobody came forward to say, hey, this doesn't make any sense. They were all scared, I believe, to do so. And so Dorothy just died, and that was it, and she basically vanished from the face of the earth.
Until you brought her back.
Well, and people like you have brought her back. You know, I applaud you for permitting me to talk about Dorothy. And it's interesting, in the new book, I'm able, in Denial of Justice, I'm able to even fill in more of the story, because I was able to track down, as you may know, Dorothy Kilgallen's butler's daughter. Her name
yes.
is Barbara Brenda DeJordan.
Right.
And I couldn't find her for the first book, and so I really was upset that I couldn't. But again, through Dorothy's guidance, I finally figured out that she changed her name. I found her in New York City. I went to New York City, spent about 4 hours with her, and she could really fill in a lot of the blanks that I had about Dorothy's life and time and her death, because the butler and his wife, James Clement and his wife, they lived in the townhouse on the first floor. It was a 5 or 6 story building, and they lived on the first floor there. So they knew everything that was going on, and Brenda and her brother Larry lived there as well. And so she was there every day with Dorothy, and she could talk about these lavish parties that I talk about in the book, with all of the biggest stars at the time coming to the townhouse. She could talk about the celebrations there and the people who came and all of that. But she also could give an insight into the actual very day that Dorothy died and what happened. And in fact, I was able to confirm what I always believed, is that Dorothy's body was not first found in that bedroom that I just mentioned, but it was found in the bathroom and then moved to the bedroom, and then the staged death scene took place there. I was able also to find out through Brenda that on the day that Dorothy died, and this was the most startling thing, that between the time that the body was found and when the police came in the middle of the afternoon, that the FBI had sent agents into Dorothy's townhouse and taken out boxes of her documents and her papers about the JFK assassination.
Isn't
which we never found. And so
yes.
Finding Brenda was amazing, and I think people will really be interested in her account of Dorothy's life and times, and what happened the day of her death.
Right. Oh, it's just, and you tell us what she was doing. She talked to the messenger to come and get the story that she had just finished. She was cognizant. She was upbeat. She was, as you said, she was planning on going back to New Orleans. She was also going to change her will. She was going to do a lot of things. And some people suggest that she committed suicide. No, she would never have done that. She just wasn't the type of person that would even consider doing that. And
she was at the top of her career. And you mentioned the medical examiner came from the Brooklyn office, not the New York office. And I proved in The Reporter Who Knew Too Much and now Denial of Justice that that was a mafia controlled, you know, medical examiner's office, which
right.
fits in with the theories as to who killed Dorothy. But, yes, I mean, you have to kind of, you know, I like my books to make people stop and think, just as you do with your radio program. So people can go into the books and they can they can make up their own mind as to what happened. But I think all of the evidence you just talked about, no question there was no suicide, and it was an accidental death. Dorothy Kilgallen was murdered.
She absolutely was. We're going to take a real quick break. We'll be right back. All righty, welcome back. Our guest, the first 2 hours today, is Mark Shaw, an incredible writer who has written about this wonderful, wonderful person, Dorothy Kilgallen, and what she was doing and attempting to do. It's just amazing. I like what you wrote about, well, Melvin Belli. You just fleshed him out. What a narcissistic, and you refer to him as a narcissist. What a character he was. He was pretty awful, and yet he was brought in to defend Ruby, which was so unusual. And you also talk about how Ruby happened to get into the basement, how he happened to be where he was supposed to be, that it was his job. The whole thing was just amazing, the way that you put that all together. I know I'm jumping ahead, but...
No, thank you. I appreciate that. And you know, I was just listening to the commercials, whatever you want to call them, for Republic Broadcasting and your show and all of these. You know, it's you guys are about the truth. And you know, one of the great lies in history is the JFK assassination. It is just lie after lie after lie. And you know, I've been working on these books, starting with the one on Melvin Belli, for what, 10, 12 years, and I've been very fortunate because I looked at it differently than anyone else had, because I'm a former criminal defense lawyer. I always look at motive, always look at common sense and all of that. And there really is no greatest murder mystery in history with how JFK was killed. It's easy to be able to put this together, frankly, when you use some common sense like Dorothy did. And so when I started with Melvin Belli, I knew him in the 1980s. I practiced law with him here in San Francisco. I got to know him. He was, his ego was the size of Texas. But he was always a little unscrupulous with what he did. He was actually a tort lawyer, as you may remember, and sued all the big companies and got all the big verdicts for millions of dollars and all that. He'd never really been a criminal defense lawyer. But when I was writing that book, I thought, well, how in the world did he end up being Jack Ruby, who shot Lee Harvey Oswald? Jack Ruby's a lawyer. Now, you know, I'm not the greatest researcher in the world or the smartest guy that ever lived, but right away you're kind of wondering, how did he end up in that case?
Right.
And so I started to look into it, and I found out that Belli had a real affection for the mafia. He was kind of a mafia wannabe, like Jack Ruby was in some ways. People would tell me, you know, he loved the mafia loved him, he spent time in Las Vegas, his main client was Mickey Cohen, who was a Las Vegas gangster and all this, and I started thinking, oh, wait a minute, you know, this whole deal with regard to JFK being assassinated, let's see if we can't tie that together. And so Belli was the glue for me of looking back and figuring out that, hey, wait a minute, we got to go back to the 1960 election. When JFK was going to lose that election, Joe Kennedy knew, unless they won a couple states, including Chicago, right where you are, Illinois, right where you are with Chicago, and West Virginia. And so Joe was smart enough to say, look, I'm going to go talk to some of my underworld buddies, Giancana and Marcello and all these guys, and see if they could help us win Illinois, especially through Mayor Daley. And that's exactly what they did. But Joe Kennedy had made a promise that if they helped JFK win that election, when the Kennedys got in the White House, they'd leave the mafia guys alone. Well, right away, and I had a witness who was right there when it happened, Joe forced JFK to appoint Bobby Kennedy attorney general. And predictably, Bobby Kennedy, who hated the mafia, went after those guys. And you can't double-cross those guys. And so, finally, this Carlos Marcello, who Dorothy figured out it masterminded the assassination, and it makes sense, and I'll explain why in a minute, but that Marcello was one of the first that Bobby Kennedy went after. He deported Marcello to the jungles of Guatemala, for God's sakes. He finally got back in the country, and then he indicted Marcello, and so it made sense that Marcello had to do something to stop this. And so what did he do? Well, if he kills Bobby Kennedy, who he hates, then JFK will come after him with everything the government has. But if you kill JFK, Bobby Kennedy is powerless. And look at, look what happened. That's exactly what happened. They never went after those mafia guys again. So Dorothy had figured all that out. But when she went to the Ruby trial, that's what really was the crowning blow, because she sat there in the front row and listened to the testimony. And Deanna, you know from reading the denial of justice that in June of last year, and I know Dorothy, you know, orchestrated this, a lawyer in Fresno, California called me and he said, Mark, I read The Reporter Who Knew Too Much. I bought it at Barnes & Noble at 5 o'clock, and I read it by the time I went to bed, and I have a gift for you. And I said, what's that? And he said, I have a copy of the Jack Ruby trial transcripts. I said, what? Yeah. He said, yes, I found them, and we don't need to go into how, but he said, I'm going to give them to you. So he did. I have them stacked over here on a table, 2,000 pages, a foot and a half tall. And it took me about 2.5 weeks to go through there and through them all. And I ended up finding about 25 excerpts that we have actually embedded the page into the new book, Denial of Justice. And it is the most primary source, most credible information about what happened with the JFK assassination ever exposed, because it is the testimony, sworn testimony from eyewitnesses who were there.
Yes, and you know, I like those pages, the way that you put them in there.
Well, okay, thank you, and I
take a real quick 5 minute or 3 minute break. We'll be right back. And he is a fabulous writer who has written this wonderful book, Denial of Justice, Dorothy Kilgallen, Abuse of Power, and the Most Compelling JFK Assassination Investigation in History. Okay, so you had all these pages.
Yeah, I had all these, pages, and what do I do with them? And I'll tell you what, I hope people really will perk up here and listen, because what I'm going to tell you, and I want to be humble about this, but these are the most important JFK assassination documents in history. They've never been exposed before. And they were ignored back in the 60s. They were ignored for five decades, and we found them. And so what I did when I went through there, how many times I said, wow, or had a shiver of something that I was reading. I mean, the books are set up as two crime murder mysteries, because there's a lot of possible suspects in Dorothy's death, and we can talk about that as well. But really, when it comes down to it, there's no question about who was responsible for Dorothy's death, because through the Jack Ruby trial transcripts, we know why she was so dangerous. Because she had listened. She had watched. We have a photograph in Denial of Justice of her in the courtroom in Dallas. We have videotapes on the DorothyKilgallenStory.org that we point out in the book of her being at the trial. And Joe Tannehill, who was the co-counsel with Belleye of Jack Ruby, talking about Dorothy and her interviews with Jack Ruby and where they took place. We have a photograph of the courtroom that shows you right where those interviews were. But she was sitting in the front row there. And I never could quite put together why she was so dangerous. But what did she hear and what did she watch that made her so dangerous? Well, if you go in, there's three places you can now look at excerpts from these documents. First of all, of course, they're in Denial of Justice, which you saw. Second, I put them up on the MarkShawBooks.com website. You don't have to buy the book. You don't have to even get it at the library. You can go find these excerpts on MarkShawBooks.com. And then I gave a presentation at the prestigious Commonwealth Club of San Francisco last month. And my presentation's up on YouTube. Just put in Denial of Justice and Mark Shaw, and you can go to see that presentation. It's about an hour, and the excerpts are up there. And what did I find? Well, I'll just give you two of the main examples. What would people feel like if they really knew that Jack Ruby, now listen to this, watched the assassination as it took place? What? That's what my reaction was when I read the testimony of two witnesses, Don Campbell, I have it right in front of me, Don Campbell, an advertising salesman for the Dallas Morning News, he's the first one, And then his colleague, Jack Newman, who's with the retail advertising staff at the Dallas Morning News. What do they testify to under oath at the trial? Both of them say that Jack Ruby was at the Dallas Morning News offices at 12:25.
Right.
And he was walking around and he was working on an ad and all of this. But what he was really doing is that he was watching because there was a window out of the Dallas Morning News offices that faced Daly Plaza and faced the book depository building. And Ruby was watching and looking out of that window, and there's testimony that he was there at 12:25, and Jack Kennedy was killed at 12:35.
Yes.
So Ruby was actually watching that, and both of these witnesses show that Ruby was there from 12:35 to at least 12:40.
Because he knew it was going to happen.
Think about that.
Yes. He knew it was going to happen.
He knew it was going to happen. He knew about the assassination before it happened. Now, I don't like to use the word conspiracy, and I won't use it one more time. I hate that word because it lumps everything together. What this shows is that for sure there was a plot to kill the president. He was watching what happened. And I will tell you this also in denial of justice. I prove that Melvin Belli also knew about the assassination before it happened because I found a witness who was with Belli in San Francisco at lunch, and a waiter came up and said, listen, Jack Ruby just shot Lee Harvey Oswald. And Belli said, well, now I'll have to represent Ruby.
Right.
So that's the first shocking, primary source evidence that shows this. This whole Oswald alone theory stuff was a bunch of crazy business that was orchestrated by J. Edgar Hoover to send everybody in the wrong direction. Now, the second one that is so important is a witness by the name of Hallmark. And Hallmark, Deanna, owned a parking lot across from Jack Ruby's Carousel Club. And he testifies that basically Ruby used to come over there and park his car at the parking lot across from the Carousel Club. And Mr. Hallmark, who's the general manager of the All Right Auto Parking facility, and again, I have the exact pages from the Ruby trial transcripts. Mm-hmm. He talks about Ruby coming over there on the Saturday before he shot Oswald. And he wants to use the public phone, and Hallmark listens. And Ruby says, wants to know and talks about when will Oswald be transferred from the Dallas Police Department basement. And then there's a pause, and then Ruby says four words that really change everything. I will be there.
Yes.
I will be there. And what that means, of course, is that he had been stalking Oswald from the moment Oswald was arrested. He had planned to assassinate him. There's also testimony in there that he made like a reporter to get into the basement and that his friends in the police department helped him get in that basement and kill Oswald. So what do we know now? We know that Ruby knew about the assassination. Belli knew about the assassination. They obviously knew about Oswald being part of that. And then Dorothy Kilgallen, using just common sense, was able to put it together that really she knew that Oswald and Ruby were connected, and we've proven that in the new book, Denial of Justice, to this Carlos Marcello, who had the main motive to kill JFK. What did Dorothy believe? It was a mob hit from start to finish. This is what they do. You go ahead and you get somebody. And Oswald was probably a bit player in this somewhere or another to kill the president. Then you bring in Jack Ruby, what? To kill him because he's a loose end and they don't want him to tell what happened. And then you bring in Melvin Belli to shut Jack Ruby up because what did he do at trial? He wouldn't let Ruby testify and he made him look like he was crazy.
Button
up everything that way, and that's exactly how it happened. I mean, there were mob hits are commonplace. And that's exactly what this was, and that's what Dorothy knew.
Right. Just what he said about Ruby, that he was insane for a while, and that's why he did it. And the fact that he wouldn't let him testify, it was just so amazing. And it's interesting that Dorothy was able to interview him. But apparently, Belli was kind of a womanizer. And, yes. I guess he went after anything in a skirt is what you, what you implied. And, she was popular. And so, and she had Hollywood connections, and he saw himself as an actor. In fact, he read for the part of,
Don Corleone, yeah.
Yes, yes.
Godfather.
Yes, he read for that part.
Yeah, he's the perfect person to bring in this, because Belli, you know, he was a mafia wannabe, a lot like Ruby, and so, you know, he's the perfect lawyer to bring into this, but nobody questioned this. I mean, there's evidence that Ruby, that Belli actually had been in front of the same judge that tried the Jack Ruby case years earlier, based on a girlfriend of his client, Mickey Cohen, the gangsters.
Right.
And so there was that tie-in, but nobody questioned that. And I'll tell you what's worse. Denial of justice is about four people. Four people deny justice. Certainly Dorothy was, as we can go into further about her death. Second, how about Lee Harvey Oswald? He never got a trial. How about Jack Ruby? He didn't get a fair trial. And of course, John F. Kennedy. I mean, it's a senseless death. He wasn't even really the target. It was Bobby Kennedy they wanted to kill. So it's denial of justice of all of those. But I actually found, and you saw in the new book, Denial of Justice, I found the journal kept by one of the jurors, Wayman Rose, in the Ruby trial, and also a book written by the foreman of the jury, Wayne Causey. And it's amazing to me that when this evidence took place on the actual days when it's proven that Ruby was watching the assassination as it took place, and that he said he would be there when Oswald was transferred, there's no comment by them in those documents, in their journals, about that, because they were all looking at this Oswald alone thing. They didn't want to get into that. They were looking at the insanity thing and all of that. They were brainwashed, basically, as was the American people and people around the world, by J. Edgar Hoover, basically sending everybody in the wrong direction with Oswald alone. And he did that on purpose, as you know, because if it was a nut like Oswald, then the FBI could not be responsible. But if there was a plot to kill the President of the United States, and the mafia was involved, or whoever it was, then the FBI would be responsible. So J. Edgar Hoover was a dangerous man, and he went ahead and protected himself, and he did that with the Warren Commission, and for years and years and years on by so-called experts who write these books. I mean, nobody else ever found these Jack Ruby trial transcripts. They're not in any of the books written by Bugliosi or Posner or Stephen King or in JFK the movie. I mean, come on. Like I say, I'm not the smartest guy in the world or the best researchers, but they were there, and fortunately I was able to find them, and I hope people now will read them and make up their own mind about what happened back in 1963.
It's just amazing, as you said, that all of this kind of just fell into your lap. Well, you did a lot of searching. Just finding the people that had the information, and to have the jury, the records of the jury, Rose.
Mm-hmm.
That was an amazing thing.
Well, again, I can only tell you that, you know, let me give you another example of Dorothy's, you know, involvement here. I was about to turn in the manuscript for the new book, Denial of Justice, last summer, and I had the feeling that there was something I'd
missed.
Something
more.
And so I thought about it for a while, and most of the ideas that I get, I don't know about you, you're a curious person, so maybe it happens to you too, they come to me in the middle of the night. I have to wake up, and I have note cards by my bed, and I write them down. And I had this strange feeling that there was something I needed to find out about Dorothy and the Warren Commission.
Mm-hmm.
She was never called by the Warren Commission, and so I wondered more about that and why. And so I went ahead and I thought, you know, I wonder if there's anything that I can research and find where there was communication by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI with the Warren Commission about Dorothy. By J. Edgar Hoover with the Warren Commission about Dorothy. So I did some research and I found that there could be a document possible. And I was able to track down a person at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., who did me a favor and went over to the National Archives. And I asked her to look up and use the words Dorothy Kilgallen and Warren Commission. And she came back to me and she basically said, yes, I found a couple boxes of things, but I don't know if they're important. And I said, well, please send them. So she did, and I looked at them. Well, what were they? Well, when Dorothy Kilgallen interviewed Jack Ruby, that was only the first of her exclusives. The other one was that she was able to get a copy of Jack Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission, before it was supposed to be released. And she went ahead and, bravery, as brave as she was, she printed that on the front page of the New York Journal American before the president saw it. And what did it show? Well, it showed all of these crazy assertions that Ruby made, and there was some material in there that Dorothy could connect with other things and all of that. Well, Hoover was just furious about the fact that she had found these documents and exposed them, and so he went after her. And I'd love for people to think about this visual. Here's little pint-sized Dorothy Kilgallen in the front room of her townhouse in New York. She's dressed immaculately, as she was on What's My Line. And here comes these two hunks, these big, strong, tough FBI agents, and they sit her down, and she's sitting on the couch, and they're across from her, and they grill her about, where did you get these documents and everything? And I was able to find a document from J. Edgar Hoover to the Warren Commission where he talks about those agents interrogating Dorothy. And in there, you will find out that she said, I'm not about to tell you anything about my sources. In fact, I would rather die than provide my sources. I will come to the Warren Commission, yes, but if I do, I'm not going to give up my sources. You talk about courage.
Yes.
Well, that was real courage. But again, Dorothy led me to those. I know she did, because it was her finest hour. She wasn't about to be intimidated by J. Edgar Hoover, and as people will find out, I don't want to give away everything in the new book, Denial of Justice, but the main suspect among everyone else is obviously J. Edgar Hoover. He could not let Dorothy Kilgallen write that book for Random House that would have exposed his cover-up of the JFK assassination and all of that. But it was her finest hour, and again, she just showed that integrity that was part of, that was the main part of the woman that she was.
You're so right. Most people would have folded in front of a couple of authority figures.
But she didn't. And see, again, she just put a target on her back, Deanna. She was getting way too close to the truth. She was making this trip to New Orleans. She had all the information from the Ruby trial,
and she
thought she was invincible.
But she did think about getting a gun.
Well, that's the thing that we can talk about. Dorothy knew she was in trouble at the end, a few days before she died on November 8, 65. She knew she was in trouble. We have videotapes where she tells one of her hairdressers, if the wrong people knew what I know about the JFK assassination, it would cost me my life. To Mark Sinclair, her main hairdresser, I'm afraid for my life and my family. I changed my will. I bought a gun. All of that. But Dorothy Kilgallen also felt like she was invincible. People can't even understand how big a star she was there, what a media icon she was. I mean, you can talk about Diane Sawyer or Oprah or whatever. They can't touch what Dorothy Kilgallen achieved in her life. But she thought she was invincible, and unfortunately, finally she was too close to the truth, and they had to eliminate her. They could not let her write that book for Random House.
You're right. And she did feel, because she had such a captive audience and so many people were aware of what she was working on, or at least that they were aware of what she had worked on, and they were aware of her television program, and she was scheduled to do another TV program. And so she was so popular, and she thought that would save her.
Yeah, she was, and again, I respect you as a person of integrity, and we need more people like you, and we need more people like Dorothy today, because unfortunately, we don't know who to believe anymore in the media.
Oh gosh. Alrighty, we've got a break, and then we'll come right back and pick this up.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Our guest is Mark Shaw. He is the author of his latest work on Dorothy Kilgallen, Denial of Justice. And it's just a tremendous piece of work. It is just fabulous. It's interesting. There's a blackout the day after she died, which I think is kind of symbolic.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? People might say, hey, why are these things important? You know, why is JFK assassination important? 50 plus years. Why is it important about Dorothy Kilgallen? Well, it's about history. And frankly, these are my contributions to history, and you're helping me do that, and I appreciate it so much because, you know, if we don't get history straight, then we're in trouble, and we have to learn from history. Government corruption took place in 1963, and it took place again in 1965. J. Edgar Hoover, brainwashed everybody with regard to what had really happened. That's government corruption. The Warren Commission was just a joke. With Dorothy Kilgallen's death, covered up by, the government. So that, you know, any time you have government corruption, it's very difficult to get the government to expose government corruption. It just doesn't happen. And I've run into that with the New York District Attorney's Office, and we can talk about that in the next hour. But, it's important because we need to learn from history. And, you know, so much of what has been put out about the JFK assassination has been a distortion of history so that people don't really understand what can happen when, you know, a president of the United States, like JFK, was a strong leader and was doing things that, you know, an awful lot of people weren't happy with and the wrong people weren't happy with. And so they just absolutely, you know, got rid of him. I mean, they used a plot to kill the president and he was gone. And you have to think about what JFK might have done if he lived and what Dorothy Kilgallen would have done if she would have lived. So these things are important. And, you know, the day after Dorothy died, for whatever reason, they had a power outage, in New York City, as you mentioned. And it was kind of symbolic that, somebody who was standing up for the truth and trying to find the truth and all of that paid for it with her life. You know, talk about censorship. Well, it's the most extreme form of censorship because you basically kill the reporter. You don't just slam what they're doing or edit it or whatever. What they had to do was they had to silence her. And so they did so by this plot that we can go through as to how they got to her and how they ended up, using barbiturates to kill her. We'll talk about in the next hour. But it's important, and I hope people will realize that, as I do hope that they will go to my website and look at those Ruby Trial transcripts, or if they can get the book. And, you know, the book is in hardback, it's in audiobook, it's in large print. It's an e-book. It's out there, but you can also get it in all the libraries or go to YouTube, as I say, and you can watch that presentation I had at the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco. So you don't need to pay any money for this. I don't care about that. I just want you to be able to look at the facts and make up your own mind. That's what's important to me.
Right. He was going to take the country in a whole new direction, and there were several groups that were out to remove him. So anyway, okay, we're at the top of the hour, and we will be right back with our guest today. Right,
thank you.
Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest the first 2 hours today is Mark Shaw, and he has this wonderful book that you must read. He said don't worry about, but you really need to read it, because he's pieced together so many facts and so much fabulous information that it is a must read for anybody that's the least bit interested in history, because history is prologue. It has changed our present. That act changed everything about what is going on today. It is responsible for everything that may be going on today. So history is vital to understand what is going on. And the name of the book, Denial of Justice, Dorothy Kilgallen, Abuse of Power, and the Most Compelling JFK Assassination Investigation in History. And I agree, that's a fabulous title.
Well, thank you. And you know, we've been amazed, you know, the Reporter Who Knew Too Much became a bestseller. And as you know, movie rights have been optioned for that book. And I hope Denial of Justice, is a better, even a better book than that one. But, so many people have been reintroduced to Dorothy Kilgallen, and you can go on, you know, YouTube, and you can watch a lot of those shows. It was a fabulous show. I mean, it was an intellectual show, unlike a lot of the quiz shows today. But you can see Dorothy Kilgallen, in person, and, the kind of person she was. You can watch her last show. She's sharp. She guesses the occupations of a couple of the contestants. She looks great. You know, there's no, you know, even no semblance of evidence that she was having alcoholic or barbiturate drug problems or anything like that.
Absolutely.
And yet, if you read the autopsy report, which you talked about, and I have that in both books, it's just a compendium of mistakes. They called Dorothy obese in the autopsy repeat. But that wouldn't even come close. It talks about one barbiturate in her stomach, secanol, which people will recognize as sleeping pills, but they fail to mention in the report that Tylenol is also in there, which is even a more dangerous sleeping pill. And I was able to find a witness, a son of a toxicologist in the medical examiner's office, who along with a colleague 3 years later, they had kept some of Dorothy's bodily fluids, and they re-examined them and found another barbiturate in there, phenobarbital. So there were three barbiturates in her stomach, and they couldn't have come from her using them. It didn't make any sense. They obviously had been taken from the capsules and poured into her drink on the night before she died. But, you know, just common sense shows that there should have been an investigation for sure. And if there had been, they would have been able to prove that she had been murdered. And I believe then at that particular point, they could have found this main suspect that I talk about in the book, trace that back to J. Edgar Hoover, and Dorothy would have gotten the justice she deserved. But that obviously is not what happened, and that's what I've been fighting for these last few years for Dorothy.
Right. They also found Pepto-Bismol. So she obviously was having an issue with her stomach. And
yeah, we're able, Deanna, as you know, to trace her last hours, her last days. She was going to make that second trip to New Orleans where she could connect Marcello with Ruby and Oswald. There's no question about that. She told everybody, I'm going to crack the JFK assassination case gonna crack it, and it's going to be the case of a lifetime. She was working on her book for Random House. We know that she showed Bennett Cerf, who was not only a panelist but also the publisher of Random House, pages from her book. But we also know that on that particular day, you know, she was her hairdresser had gotten her ready, helped her with her makeup and her eyelashes, false eyelashes, and this hairpiece. He was amazed when he watched her on the show that she didn't have on the same dress that she was going to wear, that she was going to meet somebody after the show. We know that she went to P.J. Clark's. This is where Dorothy came in to play again, because I was able to actually find people at P.J. Clark's, which is a famous tavern on Third Avenue in New York City, where Dorothy spent the last part of the last night of her life after the show. I sat right next to where she sat when I visited there. She's mm-hmm. there. Then she goes to the Regency Hotel, and people can read about where that was a mm-hmm. few blocks away from her. She died, and she met what was we first of all called the mystery man, who was a man that she was dating at the time named Ron Pataki. We know that she met him there. He mm-hmm. denies all of that, but there's no question that he was the guy. He's denied it, and I name him in the book and all of that. But then we're able to show a real common sense scenario as to how Dorothy was poisoned and then left to die in the townhouse. And she died in the middle of the night, and then her body wasn't found until the next morning. And then, as we say, there was this cover-up that went on, and the FBI came in and confiscated her documents, including her JFK assassination file. So, it was just basically the fact that Dorothy knew too much. She was a reporter who knew too much, and that was the title of the first book, and now Denial of Justice, because that's what happened, and that's the title of the second book.
Right. And you mentioned also several possible people who may have had a hand in this.
Yeah.
Not seriously, but just that were very suspect. One was Frank Sinatra, who was very, he was not a very nice person at all.
Yeah.
Terrible.
No,
he took after his mother. He never forgot anybody. You did something against him, and he was out to get you. And you also talk about.
Now, let's talk about Frank for a minute, if you don't mind.
Okay, sure. Go ahead.
When I go into a restaurant or a bar or something, and I hear Frank Sinatra, I want to throw up.
Sure.
Yes, talented, gifted singer, no question about it. But he was a bad guy.
He was.
And, Frank Sinatra, there's a photograph in the new book of him with his mafia buddies. He was a mafia wannabe like Ruby and Belle I and all those people. He loved to be around them. He loved to be the big shot. But he would beat up reporters who would criticize him. He was involved in he's a womanizer, who was treated women very badly. He got in crosshairs with Dorothy because while they had been friends at one point, she wrote some scathing articles about him, about his bimbo girlfriends and his affiliation with the mafia. And he came back and called her the chinless wonder and made fun of her appearance and sent her a fake tombstone to her office and all of that. And, he was a bad guy. And there's no question that, that Frank Sinatra had the motive to get rid of Dorothy Kilgallen if he wanted to.
Oh, absolutely.
Now,
sure.
Whether he was a part of this whole plot with J. Edgar Hoover and Carlos Marcello and Sam Giancana, who was a friend of the mobster, who was a friend of Sinatra's, I wouldn't put it past him, because you have to go back to the 60 election again, because who did Joe Kennedy use as a conduit to Sam Giancana and all of the mafia people? Well, he used Frank Sinatra, who was a friend of the Kennedys.
Right.
So Sinatra was right in the middle of all this. So when I hear songs by him and all this, I just think it's unfortunate that people, sure, they're going to listen to him, and I understand that, but they also need to know about the dark side of Frank Sinatra, and he was a bad guy, as I say.
Yes. Yes, he was a very bad guy who, as you said, he referred to women as broads, and he was just terrible. He was a piece of trash. That's all.
Thank you
was.
For saying that. I couldn't put it better. Thank you.
And you also talk about Richard, the husband, who ultimately committed suicide. What a sad, tragic figure he was. He just... he was referred to as Mr. Kilgallen, and she was really making all of the money for the household, and he was just—he was not a nice person.
Well, no, it's tragic. The whole thing is tragic. Tragedy of a senseless death of JFK and a senseless death of Dorothy. But if you go to the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, and also we have a photograph of it in the book and a link there. There was a show in the middle 1950s called Person to Person with Edward R. Murrow. And, it was a hit show, and he interviewed the the celebrities of the day, one-on-one. He used to sit there with a cigarette in his mouth, and he would interview these people. And you'll see an interview with Dorothy and Richard, and they have the two. Dorothy had three children, Carrie, mm-hmm. the youngest, Jill, the middle one, and Dickie, the older one. Mm-hmm. And you'll see two of the kids with Richard and Dorothy. And they're just the happiest people. It's a wonderful family. They talk about Richard's successful career on Broadway as a producer and Dorothy at the top of her career with What's My Line. And in there, you know, she talks about of all the careers she had, being a newspaper woman was the most important to her. I mean, this is just what? A few years before, you know, she died, you know, 8 or 9 years before she died. It's just tragic because they were so happy. But mm-hmm. Richard's life went downhill. His Broadway productions didn't do very well. He opened a couple restaurants that failed. He basically became an alcoholic, running around with every woman that he could find. And they really, in effect, became estranged. Now, they didn't divorce. Dorothy wouldn't have done that. She was Catholic, another reason right. why she wouldn't have committed suicide. But it was a sad situation, and when, you know, in the book, again, it's a true crime murder mystery, so people can make up their own mind, but Richard's a suspect because Dorothy was going to change her will. She was going to give more money to little Carrie, the son, than to Richard, so he had a lot to lose here. Now, in the book, what I give a couple motives as to why it would have happened and how it could have happened, and I'm going to leave that for the reader to take a look at. But one thing recently that has come to me, as you know, Deanna, the children, the three of them, have always failed to cooperate with any investigation into Dorothy's death, and that includes mine. I contacted Jill and talked to her, and she didn't want anything to do with it. The other two boys, I've made contact with them, the same feeling that they want to let it go. Well, that's fine, but recently I've gotten it in my own mind that some way or another, Richard might have been involved with Hoover, Marcello, these other people. He had no money. She was going to cut him out of the will. He could have been duped into somehow or another setting up Dorothy.
Accommodating.
And if that happened, it's the reason why the children would not want to get involved. I mean, their memories of this are terrible. Sure. Dorothy died under suspicious circumstances, and then, as you said, Richard committed suicide. So I've come to wonder whether they don't really suspect that Richard had something to do with Dorothy's death, and that would, you know, solidify my belief that that may be the reason why they've never wanted to cooperate with any investigation. Think that makes sense?
Yes, yes. And they were very, well, the daughter was very upset because she wanted some of her mother's belongings, and Richard just did not act appropriate as a grieving spouse.
It was just very interesting
the way that he was acting.
Didn't, and they finally had to contest the will, and,
yes.
you know, he didn't cooperate and wouldn't give Jill, Dorothy's, belongings, some of his,
the jewelry, you know, some of the things that
the jewelry
that she
and
should have had.
That's right. And we know that he lied about, the day of her death because in the autopsy, there's an interview with him by Detective Doyle. And he says that Dorothy came home around 11:30 and she had a drink
That's
and went
true.
To bed, something
yeah.
like that. Well, that is even possible based on everything that we found otherwise. So,
right.
You know, Richard certainly could have been involved one way or another, because he was at a low point of his life and either accidentally or accidentally on purpose, he could have been involved with poisoning Dorothy's drink, before she went to bed. And you know, if you want to read a very, disturbing, account of what it was like for little Carrie, her youngest son, when he came home from school and tried to talk to his dad about Dorothy dying, his mother dying, you'll read that in Denial of Justice. And the first
yes.
time I did it, brought tears to my eyes. So
yes.
I'll leave that for people to read, but it's very disturbing, that's for sure.
Yes, poor little child.
Yes.
And there was somebody also got a picture of him by himself in the park.
I think that was a warning to Dorothy.
A warning. Yes.
I think maybe you'll agree. you know, they may have, you know, she said that she had been threatened. Remember I said she told mm-hmm. the hairdresser, my family and I have been threatened, you know, in all of that. I think they may have tried to threaten her in some ways and let her know and warn her to quit getting involved in this JFK assassination. In fact, the butler's daughter that I talked about tells the fact that her father warned her to be careful. Mark Sinclair, the hairdresser, and Simpson, they both warned her to be careful.
Right.
But she kept going on, except that the fact that she must have been terrified, as you know. Right before she died, there was a photograph in a New York newspaper of little Carrie running across Central Park, and Dorothy was just so upset because it obviously showed that somebody had been following little Carrie, and that
right.
really scared her. Now, whether she would have gone ahead and stopped that investigation in the JFK assassination, we don't know, but she died shortly thereafter. So that was a warning to Dorothy, and you can imagine as a mother how terrified she was about that.
And Carrie was very special to her. It was just, you could tell there that he was special. Of course, he was the youngest child, and he wasn't Richard's child. And she felt that Richard had made an attempt to try to be a father, even though he wasn't the biological father.
That happened. You know, I'm amazed, and I just want to thank you so much because you've obviously done your homework and looked at the books and all of that, and that doesn't always happen with interviews, and so I appreciate that very much because you're bringing points to the surface here that maybe I wouldn't have talked about. All of my books, whether, you know, it's biographies or whatever, I have the good, the bad, and the ugly in my books. I try to give a balanced portrayal of the subject that I'm talking about. And this was a tough one because with Dorothy, her life was so exceptional. She was so remarkable. And when I came across this information, I didn't know exactly what to do with it because it's family matters. But through eyewitnesses, primary sources and all that, including Brenda DeJordan, I was able to show that Carrie was not Richard's biological son. Dorothy had Richard started running around with a lot of women, Dorothy was lonely, and she took up with first of all a singer who was popular at the time. His name was Johnny Ray, and his main song was "The Little White Cloud That Cried." He was much younger than Dorothy, and they fell in love. He was alleged to have been a homosexual, but obviously he was a bisexual because it had this torrid love affair. And I didn't know how far that went until one of the hairdressers in a videotaped interview talked about the fact that Carrie may very well not have been Richard's son, but Johnny Ray's. And then I was able to confirm that with two other sources, including Brenda. And so there's no question that if you look at photographs, by the way, in color, Richard has dark hair, Dorothy has dark hair, but, little Carrie has kind of blondish red hair.
Right.
So,
freckles.
That was another concluding point of that. And Dorothy then believed that Richard would not take care of Carrie because of him knowing he was not the biological father. And that tied in and connected then in with the evidence we had that she was changing her will so that little Carrie would get more of the proceeds, if she died. So wanted readers to see that. It's not something that I thought should be hidden. And I must say that most everyone who's read the books, both of them, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much and Denial of Justice Now, have thanked me for bringing that forward because it explains a lot about what was happening to Dorothy right before she died.
Right. And she was very lonely. Her husband, and they were in love when they got married. They loved each other, and for a while, things worked out really well. We do have a short commercial break. We will be right back. All righty, welcome back. Our guest the first 2 hours today is Mark Shaw, And the website is markshawbooks.com. You want to also visit the Dorothy Kilgallen Story.org. He is the author of the recent publication of this fabulous, fabulous book that you simply must buy. It's called Denial of Justice, Dorothy Kilgallen, Abuse of Power, and the Most Compelling JFK Assassination Investigation in History. And as you said, I'm glad that you did include that, some of the warts, I guess. But she was lonely, and they did have a good marriage, and then all of a sudden he fell apart, and just, he became somebody totally different than who she married. She was starved for affection, and so I don't blame her for what she did. I really don't.
You have to think about him. You know, Dorothy was such a big star. I mean, I have photographs of her around the writing studio here, and I'm looking at one right now that you know is in the new book, Denial of Justice, and that is Dorothy sitting at Warner Brothers across from Betty Davis, who was a film, you know, a huge film star at the time. Now Dorothy is 22 years old at that time. She was a college dropout at 18 years old, and there she is sitting at Warner Brothers looking at, they were looking at making a movie out of a book she had written and all of that, and there she is with Betty Davis, for God's sakes.
Right.
We have her at the Truman White House. We have her, you know, with George Harrison in the book. We have her with all of these celebrities. You must imagine how big of a star she was at the time, and here's Richard. Unfortunately, his Broadway producing career goes down the toilet. He opens a couple restaurants. They don't work. And he's being called Mr. Kilgallen by most people and everything. That's tough. That's tough to take. And so, you know, unfortunately, instead of trying to work himself out of it, he turned it to alcohol and, you know, just became not even a sliver of the man when Dorothy married him. And so, you know, what can she do? You know, she ends up finding Johnny Ray and affection there. And then this Ron Pataki, this journalist that I mentioned before, those were the two affairs she had before she died. The one with Johnny Ray was exceptional for her. I think it was true love that she had with him, and she kind of mothered him a little bit because he was younger too. So that was amazing. Unfortunately, the love affair that she had with Ron Pataki, the journalist, in my estimation, and the evidence I think proves, resulted in her death. So,
yes.
She had one wonderful love affair and the other one was lethal. That's for sure.
Yes, for sure. What a shame. And I can certainly understand why the children, wouldn't want to talk about this, wouldn't want to talk about their father. Now Carrie did have a blog spot that he, but then he took that down. It would be interesting to know whether, and when you consider it, their ages, one of them was born when? In 41. Dickie was born in 41. They had children, and then the daughter was born 2 years later, and then Carrie came along 11 years later. I think that's what it was.
I just had a reader of the book get in touch with me, and this is, again, I would encourage anybody listening to your program, if they have information about Dorothy's life and times or death, to get in touch with me, because this is where I've gotten all my information. People have kind of done the research for me, but I just had a reader who says that she's been in contact with Carrie, and he lives in Georgia, and she's been in contact with him, and you know, there may be a connection there that I might have, because Carrie actually in the 70s did start to look into his mother's death. He tried to get some information from the New York District Attorney's Office, as I have done, which is very difficult to do, as I say, corruption. Covers up corruption. You know, Carrie, I think, is the one of the three. You know, I don't know if they've read the books. I don't know. I can't tell. I have a hunch that they have. But I've always felt like that I would hear from Carrie. So maybe Dorothy is starting to make that happen, because, as you know, shortly after the book, the Reporter Who Knew Too Much was released, I was able to get the New York District Attorney's Office to say they would investigate Dorothy's death. And they promised me a thorough investigation, and I gave them all this information about the witnesses I had and the documents that we needed, the police report, all these other things. And so for about 8 months, everything was going great. I was conversing with their chief and investigator. It looked like we were going to get that thorough investigation, and then in August of 2017, they said they couldn't go any further with it. They hadn't found any evidence about Dorothy being murdered. It was just ludicrous. It was a real bogus investigation, and it just shocked me and disturbed me a great deal, and almost all of the people who had read the book, because we really felt like that we were going to get to the truth about what happened with Dorothy. I'm hoping that Carrie may know about all that, and at some point he will say to himself, look, I really want to know what happened to my mother, because if he reads the book, I will tell you, there are two accounts of Jill saying to two different people, my mother was murdered. Hmm. There's also Jill's best friend who said that Dorothy was quieted. You know, there's admissions there that they knew that Dorothy did not die of an accidental death due to barbiturates and alcohol. So I'm just hoping, Deanna, that that Carrie might come around at some particular point and speak with him, and we could get more information about what happened to Dorothy.
Indeed. All righty, we'll be right back. And I want to bring up Richard again with all the barbiturates and things that he had in his stash. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Our guest is Mark Shaw. He is the author of The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, and his most recent book on Dorothy Kilgallen is Denial of Justice, Dorothy Kilgallen, Abuse of Power, and the Most Compelling JFK Assassination Investigation in History. And whatever entity was involved, whether it's the Justice Department, the FBI, or whatever, whatever entity was engaged in some kind of cover-up has the ability to maintain that cover-up right up through today, which is why you were unable to get some information that you were seeking. Mm-hmm. But we were talking about Richard's stash of drugs.
Yeah, Carrie talks about, you know, Dorothy Kilgallen was very good at finding little bits of information that didn't make sense with regard to every case that she investigated, including the JFK assassination. For instance, you know, Jack Ruby always said that he was so distraught after JFK died, and she found in the testimony at trial that a couple of days later he was at the Dallas Morning News trying to sell this twist mechanism of some sort, a twist board of some sort. That didn't make any sense to her. And all of her columns, by the way, that she wrote about the JFK assassination, the first one, The Oswald File Must Not Close, 6 days after JFK was killed, are up on the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, and they're also in both of the books. But what you mentioned about Richard is another situation where I hope that I learned from Dorothy, because you mentioned that young Kerry Calmer, who was, you know, Dorothy's son, had a blog, and I was able to go look at it before he took it down, and found that he was really talking about the fact, and it was also in another publication, that for whatever reason, obviously Richard was involved with drugs as well as alcohol, and that he had this stash of barbiturates. And so what does that do? Well, it gives you suspect that Dorothy, you know, Dorothy died of an overdose of barbiturates. How did she get them? Well, if Richard had a stash of those, and that was Carrie's word, stash, that you used, then it's not difficult to believe that what I talked about before, that, you know, Richard's down and out. He's an alcoholic. He's not thinking straight. He knows that Dorothy's not having anything to do with him anymore. She's having this affair with this journalist, Ron Pataki. You know, he's upset that the will's going to be changed and all this. Well, if he has those drugs and have the availability of them, then it isn't a great stretch to believe that, you know, let's say on the last night she died that, you know, Dorothy couldn't sleep and she said, I need something to help me. And so whether he's drunk or not and knows what he's doing, the possibility, of course, is, and I say that's why this is a true crime murder mystery. People can make up their own mind, but the possibility exists that he goes to this stash of his and he gets these barbiturates, and unfortunately, either accidentally or accidentally on purpose, he takes those capsules, empties it into a drink. She was a vodka and tonic drinker, and empties those barbiturates in there, and those are the cause of death. She's poisoned by those barbiturates. So it's that little thing that I learned about from Carrie, that Richard had access to those kinds of drugs, that, you know, it connects in with the mystery of all of what happened with Dorothy when she died.
And he was a weak individual, very weak individual who was vulnerable to...
Vulnerable is the word, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, he, you know, and he's jealous.
Yes.
You know, we see this a lot in celebrity marriages where, you know, one person, when they marry, they're both on top. And then, mm-hmm. you know, one of the partners has a downfall of some sort. And so there's the jealousy that comes in there. And here Dorothy is out there and she's, you know, telling everybody she's going to crack the greatest murder mystery in history, JFK's death. She's going to solve all that and everything. She's getting all the publicity. She's on What's My Line. She's at the radio show. She's got the newspaper column. She's got everything. And if somebody came along and said, listen, we'd like for you to help us. We've had it with your wife and she needs to stop investigating the JFK assassination and we'll make it worth your while. In fact, it's interesting because, the chief investigator for the New York District Attorney's Office, Richard Ramos, when I first began talking to him, he talked about the fact that Ron Pataki, the journalist, could have very well been susceptible to being bribed to set up Dorothy. Well, the same thing could have happened with Richard based on his access to those barbiturates.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And since she was so busy, who knew who he was hanging around with?
Very true. Very true. Good point. Very good point. And thought of that. Very good point.
They had a lot of celebrities in their home. Just on a regular basis, at Christmas time particularly, uh-huh. Their home was just, inviting and, she attracted people. Jane Mansfield was there, and who was there the morning that they discovered her body? Which star was that?
That was the actress.
What's her name?
Betty Davis, but Joan Crawford.
Crawford. Yes.
Yeah. And Brenda, again, you know, you like to do this, and so do I. You want to find these primary sources, and that's why finding Brenda DeJordan, Dorothy's butler's daughter, was gold, because she was right there in the townhouse. And I don't want people to think that these are sad books in a lot of ways, because I really do talk about, you know, Dorothy's life and times, and there's all of these incredible images in the book of Dorothy with celebrities and all of that. But what you just talked about shows the celebrity status that she had. This townhouse that we had was kind of that she had a, was kind of a mansion on East 68th Street. That was the place to go. Mm-hmm. And when she had these parties, I mean, Brenda talks about Jane Mansfield. You mentioned being at one of those parties and starting to take off all of her clothes, and James Clement, the butler, has to help her put them back on. There's an interesting story of James going to the door and opening the door, and here's this small in stature African American man. And right off the bat, without any prejudice, really, he thinks it's a delivery guy, and it ends up being Sammy Davis Jr.
Right.
And, you know, they were all there. Johnny Mathis was there. I was able to find a woman that has been his partner for many, many years and interview her. She lives in Los Angeles with Johnny. And I was able to find out from her that Dorothy had a shoe collection, but she went further than that. She had an autographed shoe collection.
And
I was able to confirm that Johnny Ray had signed a pair of his shoes for her. And so, you know, it was a wonderful time of her life. And that's what's so tragic about the fact that she ended up dying at the age of 52 years old. It's just tragic. That's for sure.
Okay. There was, Pataki. I kind of wondered about him because she knew that the people around her, she trusted the people around her, and they were more like family. The people that lived within the home, there was a tutor, Carrie had a tutor, they were upstairs on the fourth floor, so they wouldn't have heard anything. But It was like family. And she, Dorothy treated these people like family. She was very giving and loving, and accepting of so many people, that other, she didn't consider them servants, but she considered them her family, and they were with her children, and her children obviously, had a very good relationship with the people who lived there and cared for their needs, because Dorothy did leave on a frequent basis, but she knew that her children were safe.
Well, the whole story of how she found the butler and the butler's wife, James Clement, and, you know, we have a picture in there of James, and, you know, he was an African-American. They went to a party at another people's home and saw James and his wife was the cook. And, you know, there, and they were enamored with them, and they invited him to their home, and then they became, basically, in many ways, her best friends.
Right.
Two hairdressers, and James and, his wife, they were her best friends. And she was very close-mouthed. She had a circle of friends, outside Joan Crawford and some others in the celebrity status. But for the most part, some people at What's My Line, but for the most part, she was a homebody in many ways. She was away a great deal, and she was covering all the big events of the time, all the Broadway openings and all of this.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, she also was treating these people like they were family. And there's an account in Denial of Justice that I think people will really enjoy that Brenda talks about in terms of what, you know, that they were at the dinner table and they were looked upon almost as her children in that way. She had that side to her. Yeah, she was brash. Yeah, she was tough in her columns. If she didn't like what some celebrity was doing, she would go after them and all of that. She had a poison pen side to her. She was tough. But at home, she was this soft woman. Johnny Raven mentioned she was the softest woman he ever knew. And she loved him and he loved her. And so that was a very special relationship for her when it all collapsed with Richard. But that's a side to Dorothy that, and you'll read about her exploits, you know, at an early age, she was involved in something called the Race Around the World where she, raced, reporters from two of the other newspapers, the Times and one of the other ones, and they ran around the world in commercial jets.
Right.
From all around the world. And it was kind of a race around the world. And Dorothy took on these two men. And I was able to find a book that she wrote about it called Fly Baby Fly, which they made a movie out of. And I was able to find that book and excerpts from that are in the new book, Denial of Justice, because they show, how much fun she had. And while she was serious about the race, she was courageous in getting into all these small planes and in the commercial planes and all of that at the time. So, you know, I just have such respect for her, and I'm so pleased that I was able to bring her back to life now, and people can learn more about this incredible woman.
And she was incredible. They were eating Dale's sandwiches and things, and it was just amazing. I had forgotten about that. That's kind of right at the beginning of the book. Uh-huh. And, yeah, it was great. And she loved her father. Her father,
Good. Yeah.
Her father was, a newspaper guy, and, she wanted to be like her dad. She was very close to her father and to her mother also. And her mother may also, blamed Richard for her death, but she was very close to her parents. And she did talk them out of going to college, and she was at the newspaper office, and one time she wanted to stay overnight to finish something. She was so dedicated. This was her life, her love, and it began early because she saw what her father was doing. And
People have told me readers have told me, and again, I think at last count, I've gotten almost 1,000 emails from people around the world, and I mean around the world, Australia, India, Germany. I just talked to a guy the other day from Sweden. You know, people have just become enamored with Dorothy. But, you know, you talk about her father, and you know, that's amazing in many ways, because Jim was a crack reporter, first in Chicago and then moved the family to New York. But he was the foundation for her. He was the role model for her. He told her the most important thing about anything you're going to do is find the truth.
Yes.
That's it. And that was her credo the rest of her career. She didn't, you know, this fake news we have these days, Dorothy wouldn't even have known what that was, because unlike people today who throw out these scandalous headlines, you know, that have no basis to them and then fit facts to those conclusions, Dorothy never did that. She went out and found the facts. She printed the facts. She let people make up her own mind. And she got that from Jim. And, mm-hmm. And then, you know, it was just predictable, because she saw him, what he was doing and who he was interviewing and how excited he was about his job. And so she trailed along with him. Finally, he got her an internship at the New York Journal American, which was one of the biggest newspapers at the time. And pretty soon then she said, look, I don't want to go to college at all.
Right.
I want to be a newspaper woman. And she started right away. You said that point about staying all night and rewriting something. She didn't care about her status as a woman. She took on all of the male reporters, and she kind of became what we would call one of the guys.
Right.
Remember when she's on that trip around the world, you know, she's hanging out with them and she's drinking with them and she's having fun with all those people. She didn't see any gender barrier. She didn't see why, you know, that there could be anybody who would think that women couldn't do what men could do. I mean, it's ludicrous as today. It was just as ludicrous back then. It's just so, it's stupid. It doesn't make any sense. But there were those barriers to her, but Dorothy was never going to let those barriers get in the way of her succeeding at what she wanted to do. And most of all, that was being as much of an integrity type reporter as her father was.
Right. And I don't think anybody ever viewed her other than what she was, just a reporter who was seeking the truth. They didn't view her as, oh, this woman.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, if you don't mind. I hope it's in the photographs in the book, but in both books, A Reporter Who Knew Too Much and Denial of Justice. But on the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, there's a larger photo. It's Dorothy at the Dr. Sam Shepard case. And if people remember, Dr. Sam Shepard, mm-hmm. it was a famous case in Ohio. He mm-hmm. was charged with killing his wife, and it became the movie, the Fugitive with Harrison Ford and the television series and everything. There's a photograph of her standing in the middle of the courtroom, and all the other reporters, Deanna, as you know, are standing around her in admiration.
Mm-hmm.
That was Dorothy Kilgallen. And that's
right.
Who she was, and that's her legacy for sure. But that photograph says everything.
It does. It really does. I'm so glad that you included all the images. It just really gives you more of an insight as to her standing with her peers, although she was above her peers in many respects.
Well, she was, but
they respected her.
Yeah, and also with her family. There's a wonderful, maybe you saw the wonderful photograph of she and Jill, or her and Jill, I guess it would be, her and Jill and Carrie at a piano. And she's playing the piano, and they're singing together. I mean, that says it all about the kind of mother that she was.
When she was home, she was a mother. And you could tell just the way that she's down on the floor playing with them, Yeah, she was a mother. Yes.
Absolutely. Yes.
All righty. We have a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. All righty. Welcome back. This is Deanna. And we have Mark Shaw. He is the author of Denial of Justice, Dorothy Kilgallen, Dorothy Kilgallen, Abuse of Power, and the Most Compelling JFK Assassination Investigation in History. One thing that we haven't touched on is that the gentleman, the DA, District Attorney Henry Wade, was kind of a friend of Ruby's, correct?
I would go to, again, this is not me speaking. This is the trial testimony, Ruby trial transcripts, testimony speaking. It's right there. It's in the book on my website, markshawbooks.com. You can see this as well, where there's testimony, not only that Ruby watched the assassination as it took place, not only that he was stalking Oswald and he got into the basement, you know, he was going to be there when Oswald was transferred. He got into the basement, making like a reporter. He used the police department friends to get in there, but also the night that Oswald was arrested, you know, and they had this news conference. Here's Ruby up in the police headquarters. He got in there acting like a reporter again. And he's introducing, listen to this, introducing other reporters to Henry Wade, the district attorney. Henry, come right. over here. You know, yes. and all of that. I mean, it's mind-boggling.
Now, isn't that
amazing?
People
are going to ask themselves, how did they miss all this? How did the report? I just had a colleague of mine go to the Southern Methodist University in Dallas and look to see what the newspaper, you know, editions had in it about the this time that this kind of evidence was being presented at the trial. There's nothing in there. Somehow or another, they were so brainwashed by Hoover about Oswald alone that they missed it all. It's not even in any of those newspaper accounts. It shows that Ruby was a friend of the district attorney who's prosecuting him, for heaven's sake.
Yes. Isn't that amazing?
You can't make that up.
No. Oh, my gosh. And, of course, Dorothy never testified before the Warren Commission. It was just, and they were, of course, Hoover. Hoover called the Warren Commission as a cover-up, and it's been covered up ever since. But but you have brought all of this to the forefront, and it's, I'm just so happy, and I respect your work so much, and I'm so grateful that you've done this.
I'll tell you what, they can look at all the books written about the JFK assassination. You'll never find Dorothy Kilgallen in there.
Nope,
it's not
you won't
any
find
other.
A word. Not
because,
a word.
They're all in that Oswald alone, you know, euphoria somewhere or another, out in that fog or whatever, and Dorothy wasn't that way, and so they're not going to permit her voice. So hopefully in the future, young people and others will let Dorothy get into the action, because I do believe, as the subtitle says, it's the most credible JFK assassination in history, and she's responsible for it.
Yes, and she was born in Chicago. So
that's right. Yes.
I live in the suburbs, and I would be tempted to try and find where she was born, and I feel a closeness to her because of your work.
Well,
and I thank you for that.
Well, she, you know, I'm a Midwesterner myself. I'm originally from Indiana, and so I will tell you, I think, you know, and with all due respect to the West Coast and everything, there's Midwestern values like you have and like Dorothy had. Absolutely.
Yes. Well, thank you so very much for being on the program, Mark.
Oh, thank
Take
you.
Care.
I appreciate it so much. You're the best, so thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much. Bye-bye. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Alrighty, stay with us with our next guest. We'll be right back.